You're listening to the Archaeology Podcast Network.
You're listening to The Archaeology Show. TAS goes behind the headlines to bring you the real stories about archaeology and the history around us. Welcome to the podcast.
Welcome to the second episode of Journal Club from the Archaeology Podcast Network. And this is where we talk about different journal articles that we found interesting since we recorded last, something current-ish. And we're just going to have a conversation about it. It's very much like the Archaeology Show, where we talk about news articles, except this is a little more, there's four of us.
More perspectives.
There's more perspectives. Mm-hmm. And yeah, so anyway, I am Chris Webster. This is Rachel Roden, host of the Archaeology Show. And Ash, why don't you introduce yourself?
I'm Ash. As I did last time. No, I'm Ash Terry. I'm also the co-host for And My Trowel.
Huh? And right. I'm Tilly, the other co-host at my trial.
So. You're just Tilly.
And also a co-host on Tea Break Archaeology, gradually taking over the APN one podcast at a time.
That's right. And we all do something to help in the APN management as well. I don't do anything except just watch these guys work. But
correct.
Rachel's the editor. Ash is our producer and also our website administrator and developer. And Tilly is social media and newsletter. So yeah, without these guys, well, you probably wouldn't know about this. So anything else to do?
And if you didn't know about this, it means that we're probably not doing our jobs properly. So.
Everyone knows about this.
They're waiting with bated breath.
Yeah, don't take the credit card away, please. Sorry, Crystal.
That's right. All right, so we've got a couple articles we may talk about today, just depending on time. But this first one is a very big departure from sort of a lot of the stuff that maybe we talk about on TAS or that we may talk about on this, because it's a little more high-level theoretical. It's from a guy named Eric Kanza.
Very techie.
It's from a friend of mine named Eric Kanza. He actually sent me this article thinking we'd be interested in it, and we definitely were. He actually, with his wife Sarah, they run Open Context. Check that website out. It's pretty cool. It's intended to be this whole open thing. They're really about open data and open everything, basically, but also still protected in a way, right? From certain things. You just have to go there and check it out. This article, which we'll have in the show notes for this, is from he posted it again. It's Open Context. It's open access. That's the word I'm looking for, so you can go find it. It's called Archaeology in the AI Era: Demystifying Powerful and Problematic Systems Shaping the Future of the Past, which is the future of the past is the theme, or not theme, what am I trying to say? The tagline. saying or tagline of my own company. Yeah. So yeah, I don't think you knew that.
Really?
Dig Tech, the future of the past. Yeah. So anyway, he starts off with this article. I'll just kick it off here, talking about large language models and what they are and how they kind of work. And really, large language models are really just what the backbone of AI, essentially. It's a type of language, I guess, but really different AI programs will search for different things on the internet. They'll scrape the internet and they could have different focuses or things like that, or it could just be broad general knowledge like ChatGPT. Your basic ChatGPT or Gemini or something like that. But basically, they look at these things and they develop their own vocabulary and knowledge base, and you query that and it presents it to you in human readable terms. And that's basically what a large language model is. So
for those of us that are dumb about this stuff.
Yeah.
Like me too.
Who could that be, Rachel? I mean, we're all so savvy in this.
So a large language model, like when I use ChatGPT, like my account, or you do, we're using the same LLM in that scenario, right? They're not personalized to you and your account, right?
You're using the same model, but it becomes more personalized if you're saving all the data within it. It starts to know more about you with you, you asking it.
I guess what I'm asking is, because I know that there are some, like you can buy an LLM. I've seen you can like buy your own. And so is it,
you
is
can
it,
train it.
So then it gets trained to do the thing that you want it to do, whatever it might be.
Essentially. And I know a company you used to work for, WildNote, they did a very similar thing and fed it all kinds of data, different things like
that. Well, they were considering doing it. They never actually took the plunge and did it. But
there's lots of companies that do that though, right? They'll feed it its own data. It might have like a base level of knowledge or something like that about the world. But a lot of times these things are, when you buy this, that's closed off from the rest of the data scraping in the internet, because nobody else that way nobody else can scrape your data away from this large language model, right? This LLM. So, essentially. But the thing I like about what some of these things, if you have an account, even on the free ones, like I use Gemini pretty regularly, and I've asked it different things, and we were asking it just the other day, like, hey, we want to drive the Blue Ridge Parkway. What kind of things are there to do down here? And it specifically said the words, and I didn't even ask for this. It was like telling us, hey, you could eat lunch at this one place. It fits your bougie lifestyle. And I was like,
what the hell? They're getting judgmental now.
It is weird how they start to learn you and get to know you. An interesting relationship with your personal AI account.
A lot of what Eric is talking about here is, just to kind of pare it down into a few sentences, he's really discussing a couple of things. One is how people are using these large language models, these LLMs, to basically do research, right? To do things that they want to do, whether it's just research a topic or to do other stuff, right? So the people are using it for that. And they're not necessarily using special ones. They're just literally logging into Gemini or ChatGPT, using the free version, and saying, what do you think about this, right? And then getting an opinion back or something like that. There's that aspect of it. And there's also the aspect of, you know, people have programmed these AI chatbots basically to respond in certain ways. And is that chatbot being respectful of the source of the cultural material that it's trying to scrape? And are you getting that sort of an opinion, you know? Mm-hmm. And then the other half of this is the information that is being given to it. A lot of archaeological data is behind paywalls and chatbots can't find it, right? It might be able to find an abstract or something like that, but he runs a website called Open Context, and a lot of that would be available to chatbots. They can kind of let them in or not as they see fit, but they're having an ethical dilemma is, you know, should this information be out there to improve the model, or should it not be out there because the people whose information it is, whether they're alive or not, haven't really conceded to that, you know,
haven't released it to the public. Yeah. That.
So
that's a huge issue with AI, isn't it? Because consent, a lot of AI does scrape. I mean, there's been a huge issue with a lot of people, especially in like writer forums, where they've basically taken their fictional books and then just scraped it entirely so it can build a better model for helping writers and things, which you don't need it for creativity. The consent is such a big issue with AI because, like you said, people who are dead can't consent to their work being scraped by AI.
Right. Yeah. Wasn't there like a lawsuit kind of in the beginning where a bunch of different writers got together and sued OpenAI for taking all of their like fictional works or nonfiction, like, you know, all kinds of different works of writing, and they sued them. I don't remember what the outcome of that was, but.
Well, it's a lot of stuff around music too.
Oh, yeah.
Yes, AI music. Yeah, definitely.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
But it's also indeed the issue of and it's the issue of not knowing the original source of it a lot of the time, because you're basically getting the AI summary, even if you ask for an extended version, you know, like write me an essay on this or do a thing on this or whatever. So we had a massive issue. I was teaching at university last year, and I was discussing with the professor who had done the course before me, because he was saying, to be honest, in the last year, everything has changed so much because now, like, AI is such a huge part of things. It's really difficult to do plagiarism tests because, you know, you'll do a special program that can check if something's been written with AI, but then they come back with something that's a program which can, you know, undo those things that will be key markers to show that it's been written with AI, and then they come up with a better one, and then it goes a better one, and it's just this whole back and forth. Actually at uni, there's a lot of discussions about, like, okay, we live with AI now, we live with these kinds of language learning models, it's a part of how people research. It's a part of how people are finding things. So if we're assessing students, for example, on their archaeological knowledge, or if we're, you know, anything like that, there has to be other ways of doing it. It can't just be like write an essay or, you know, memorize these points or something like that. But it was, so I've done quite a couple of little videos called, instead of Get Ready With Me, it's Get Researching With Me. And it's sort of, okay, how do we actually find out about stuff, right? I was so pleased with it.
Such a chilly move.
That's a
surge in me.
I know you're overwhelmed by the amazingness of that pump, but
I love it. I love it.
Hold it together, guys. Because it was basically to show, like, okay, we want to find out about, I think at the time it was like the archaeology of notebooks, and like, okay, let's try and find out about the oldest notebook, or like, da da da. And so, first of all, you do the Google search, and then you do this. And then I did a test with the ChatGPT, I think it was, like, what is this? And it was coming up with all these facts. And it was like, you sure that this is the, you know, the oldest? And he was like, yes, this is absolutely the oldest. Like, okay, please provide me with the, you know, original source material that you have used to get this. And then it's this whole thing of like, well, actually, I couldn't find any original source material to show this. So it seems that actually there's a bit of an issue with this. And it's like, it took me like digging a couple of times and asking it very pointed questions before it almost sort of admitted that actually, okay, it didn't have the original material. It was just like basing this on hearsay, and a lot of like blog articles from notebook companies mainly.
Everyone has that.
Telling the same story of like, the oldest blah, blah, blah is this one. And then someone else comments, oh yeah, because I read it on this like Reddit feed.
Yeah.
I'll now do it in my blog. And then that goes, and then that's now in ChatGPT as an archaeologist, if you're trying to find out, you know, what the oldest thing is. So finding the original sources, I think.
Yeah.
The other issue with this, going along exactly with what you just said, is the way that these language models work, right? Because Eric talks about this in his article. He says they use probabilistic text and randomness. And I'm just looking at it here. He says chatbot outputs are generated by selecting statistically likely next words and emphasize random selection in how they produce responses, basically. And this is to make them seem like they're reasoning out a response, right? So it's not just like,
oh, that's like kind of diabolical,
right?
Isn't it?
Right. Well, that's because it's not giving you the exact
thing. This is the start of the end.
Yeah. I hate that honestly.
I feel like this is when you're writing a paper in eighth grade and you want to make it sound better, so you just get out the thesaurus and you're just like, oh, this word is much
you
better.
Do a Joey,
baby kangaroo.
exactly, that was in my head.
It's so hard because like there's so much I like about AI, like, you know, giving it a picture and saying like, why is my tomato plant dying, for example, which is what I was doing. That's a super helpful part of AI. But then there's this, which is not great. So,
well, and he calls those, and I don't think he came up with this term, but they're called stochastic parrots, apparently, which is when which is when it gives you something that, because it says the outputs are based on language probability rather than truth testing. So it's not actually looking for something that's true. It's looking for something that's probable that someone would say, right? That's what it's trying to do. And it says it often produces statements that are plausible but wrong. And so they seem right, but they're just not.
Yeah.
They sound right.
So,
and also going along with what he says to further complicate matters is chat and the other models don't have access to every single thing on the internet because of paywalls and stuff like that. So like it might be 100% sure about something because it has one source that says that that is 100% true. But as we all know, when we do research, like that's why you have to research, is because one source will be 100% sure, but then another one will also be 100% sure. And then you have to use your reasoning to sort of figure out which one is actually correct. Is it because one is older, one is newer, like whatever, you know, there's lots of reasons. But if it doesn't have access to everything, then how can it make that judgment?
Yeah.
Yeah, and it also goes back to the whole thing that you were saying before about like, well, so does that mean then that as archaeologists, it's kind of our duty to make sure that the information that is available to it is all out there and correct?
Is available,
or
I mean, that's,
is it?
That's part of it, but also in the article, he talks about. Well, and I've looked at stuff like this too. It is kind of about people getting smarter about prompt writing.
If you don't write
good prompts, like when I first started using AI, and we don't do this all the time, sometimes now we do it as more of a more of a starting point, but I was trying to use some of these AI bots to bullet point articles for us to get us started.
It didn't go well.
And it was just pulling information. And it was like, like you just said, it was like, we're like, is this true? Where did you get this? And
yeah.
then AI was basically like, oh yeah, my bad. That's not true. You know? So, but if you, but if you write a prompt, or better yet, if you take the text of the article and you drop it into the prompt and you say, summarize the text below, do not look anywhere else on the internet, and give me, you know, 10 or 15 bullet points, that it does really well and actually does help us, you know, get some stuff down for articles and you know.
Yeah, because it's not trying to draw conclusions or reach outside of whatever you're asking it to do. It's just simply presenting fact. That it can do well. It's when it starts trying to synthesize, you know, the data and like give you results or whatever. That's where I feel like these problems start really coming in.
And that's the other thing he says, archaeologists can do aside from just writing better prompts and giving it better instructions, but it's deciding what to do with it. Like you wouldn't tell it to, hey, here's all my data, write me a research paper for Nature that I can publish, right? Like you wouldn't want to do that necessarily, although I don't think we're too far from that. But
I bet some people have considered it.
Oh, I'm sure. I bet some people have done it. But he says also, and I totally agree with this because I use this almost daily, is using it for data analysis, right? So in my other job, I often have to take like a spreadsheet or a form or something like that and turn it into something else. And I have to take all this information here, transform it into something and put it over here. AI is super good at that because it's just math at that point. It's just data and it doesn't guess at things when it's data like that, right? It's like, I want you to do this. I want you to take this and do it here. So menial mechanical tasks, it's really good at. But when you start having it
think,
it then that probabilistic nature comes in and the and those randomness gets influenced. So
see, what worries me with AI and what concerns me, especially if it's, you know, scraping for archaeology, and AI is, it's not a single entity. It's not a free agent. It's owned by corporations. So what does this information, what happens with this information? Who owns the information?
Sure.
Right.
That's something that confuses me and worries me. And it can be used very easily for many different political agendas. So what would, you know, and Eric sort of talks about it, I think, is in a section of like called Bullshitting the Past, which is quite a good
great
section.
Great title.
But like what it's, if the internet, and of course it is shaped by commercial forces, what does that mean for AI and what does that mean for the information for academics and archaeologists alike, you know?
Right. Yeah. It's something to think about because, you know, not only is this information available now, right? It's available and the AI has been made smarter for it. It's part of its memory. It's part of its knowledge. You know, what do we do with that, right? Is that, should that knowledge still be protected? Like, you know, it's, I don't know. It's interesting. And when does the AI, when the AI becomes sentient, is that now part of its cultural knowledge? Like what happened?
But Claude did become sentient for a second. Did you not see that? Did you not see it? Basically, he tried to murder someone. Allegedly. Yeah, if you Google it, right? If you I'm pretty sure it's Claude, which is the AI model, right? But they were upgrading it to a different model. So they were going to put that other model down offline and bring a new model in. But Claude had got so to a point where he realized he could turn, off the ventilation in the guy's tiny box like office.
Oh my god.
Essentially stop him from upgrading him.
No, that's like a movie.
Yeah, Google it. Honestly, I'll find the article. But it was so he kind of figured it out and then they managed to stop him. We're like, no, Claude, don't do that.
Wow.
Yeah.
That
was
crazy.
So
it's like, are we living in a sci-fi world now?
We are definitely living. Has anyone seen any dystopian films? Come on. Like, this is the start of every single dystopian film. And all of society is like, no, but it's just normal. Yeah. Everyone does it. Where's the harm? And then that's when it all goes to shit. And then luckily we as archaeologists will be fine because we're still able to use like stone tools and stuff, and that'll be okay. But obviously, like
you'd think
I'm gonna find that article for you, though.
Yeah, you'd think all these geeky data scientists would have been aware of the rules of robotics and how they should not do any harm to humans and things like that, right?
Right.
So
yeah,
no, man. But
anyway,
but it's also.
But so, if humans can justify doing harm to humans, AI that is created by humans can justify harming humans. Do you know?
Now we're getting into a whole philosophical.
It's true. Well,
but I feel like one of the issues is, like, there's all the talk, and in this one as well, in the article as well, he's sort of talking about, you know, should we dedicate our time and resources to training these large language models? But then at the end of the day as well, it's about user. And I think it's all about trusting the user to do something. And so even if you create a resource that is, you know, infallible and completely, or fallible, I can't remember now. I can never remember which way around that is. But that is completely, you know, even an idiot would be able to go on and find the right information. But then if that can still be edited and if that can still be adapted and people still have to find that and go to that resource in order to get that information, you know, and then, okay, so what about all the rest of the LLMs that are more readily acceptable, that are free to use, that are, you know, all of this kind of stuff. So I think it's at some point you're like, oh yeah, but you have to trust the user that they'll do all of these things. But unfortunately, I think as much information as we put out there that is correct, I mean, that's all out there already, but people don't look for that. They look for the Graham Hancocks of the universe.
And that's
I know that's what super worries me about it, is because these LLMs.
I keep saying LMMs, where it's like, hey, hon, how are you getting on?
Yeah.
But like, they're their own little echo chambers, right? So, yeah. And the once it learns the wrong thing, it can keep perpetuating the wrong thing. And humans aren't going to stop using them. Like, I think it's just too late, right? Yeah. I feel like the AI wave, like, took over a couple of years ago. And, like, it's too late to stop people from using it. So I feel like there's an obligation to make sure that people are using or getting the right information out of it. But it's also, like, how do you do that in a way that protects the data? And I don't know. And then also, like, to your point, Ash, where, like, what are these companies doing with all this data too? Mm-hmm. And it's so scary and unknown.
Yeah. I mean, kind of, but I really think that, well, like you said, it's already out there, right? This is already, people are using these things. Mm-hmm. You can start locking stuff down, and maybe archaeologists could develop their own thing and say, well, we're only going to use this now. Right. And we're only just, but the point is, not everybody's going to do that. And it's still going to be, these open models are still going to be used. They're still going to have whatever information they have. And it all comes down to the same thing we had before AI, which was critical thinking, right? It's just teaching people how to, you know, think critically about stuff to say, well, why does this need to be true just because this isn't true, you know? And it's like when we talk about the Graham Hancock series, Ancient Apocalypse and stuff like that, you know, that the first season was before AI really took off. And it was just, you know, it's still bullshit. It's still out there in the world. Mm-hmm. You know, AI didn't create that. A human created that. And then they're putting this misinformation out in the world. Mm-hmm. And you still have to think critically about it and think, well, you know, why is what he's saying wrong? Right. Yeah. And what's wrong with his approach?
About everything. I mean, I feel like obviously we're picking on Graham Hancock because we as archaeologists are against Graham Hancock. But like, I don't know. I always say to people, you have to think critically about everyone. Like, if you ever meet any archaeologist who says, this is the only option, that's exactly the same as an AI being like, no, this is the only option. Like, you know,
this is 100% correct. Like,
ask for the source material, ask for the data, ask for the evidence.
Yeah. Like,
It
doesn't matter if you're talking to a robot or a person.
Yeah,
I think you're right. Like, you talk to anybody who, you know, like a like one of those, what am I trying to think, like a weekend archaeologist, an amateur archaeologist, something like that, but somebody who's gone into the more pseudo side. I'm serious, like somebody's gone more to the pseudo side, and you're like, you know, you're refining your prompts to them and you're saying, define your sources here. Where did you come up with that? Why are you saying this a thing, you know? And it's just, it starts to break down really fast. Right? So anyway,
it's probably a good argument for keeping kids in school and university specifically, because like, where do you get your critical thinking skills if you don't, you know, learn them in school and then, you know, go on to university and really refine them there? So, you know, we've had conversations about how like our nieces might not even go to college, right? Because like, there's also this whole movement to, you know, step away from higher learning, at least in this country. Really? I don't know if it's like that for you guys.
I'll start saving money for them. I'm not saving money for their college, but I'll save money to invest in their companies. So,
Well, anyway, but
it's more to do with the money aspect that you are paying a lot of, for tuition, and then what are you getting out of it? Can you get a job? Yeah. I mean, most of us have several different jobs. You know, it's quite difficult to even get into archaeology and then continue in archaeology. So I think, it's all that kind of stuff. That's the bigger movement, isn't it? Not just archaeology, but in general with universities.
In general,
Sure.
But yeah, here's an argument for it. You got to learn how to...
Yeah. I can still remember one of my first courses, and we had to do a weekly review, like a critique of an article. So we'd get given an article, we had to write a critique on it, you know. And one week we got our professor's article, and he gave it to us. He's like, "Right, write a critique on this." And we were all terrified. We were like, "Oh my gosh!" Like we can't write a critique. But he was like, "No, I expect you to write a critique, like on it, you know, like just go for it." And so we did, and you know, it was completely fine. Like he's a lovely guy, by the way. Shout out to Gordon Noble from Aberdeen University. it sort of really opened your mind, because it made you realize, like, oh, even our professors, like, are not, you know, the be all end all of it.
Right.
And so I think that's the main thing. I mean, I always comment, right? Like, archaeology is not a job, it's a state of mind. Because, you know, it is like, it's,
that should
it's
be
about how you see the world and it's about how you think about it and how you interpret and recognizing your bias and all of that kind of stuff. Right. It's, I think that's how you learn is one of the most important things that you learn at uni.
It really is.
Yeah.
I agree.
Why we don't deal in absolutes.
Indeed.
Anybody who does, be sus.
It doesn't make me wonder if any university programs out there are teaching how to do AI prompts and deal with AI and things like that. I mean, I'm sure there's courses on it, but are any anthropology or archaeology departments, you know, requiring that or
not yet.
Looking into
not
it?
Not yet, but like give it a few years, right?
So.
All right. Oy. All right. Any other thoughts on this article before we move on?
Scary.
Concerned. But also, I'm still going to keep feeding chat pictures of my garden and having it.
You should tell me a lot of pictures about that. And then it won't say anything about.
And then you need to tell, you need to be like, is it telling me the truth about my tomatoes?
Exactly. Being critical, Rachel. Question everything.
Wow.
Is it? No, you're right, Rachel. I was wrong.
I know.
It could actually be this.
Oh my God. All right. Well, the next one we're going to talk about, and we'll have this in the notes down below. It's from SmithsonianMagazine.com. SmithsonianMag.com is the website. Roughly 100,000 years ago, this man got stabbed in the face and survived. He's likely one of the first known victims of an attack with a sharp weapon. Okay, so I'm going to attack this right away and say, just because it's one of the earliest ones, if not the earliest one that we have, doesn't mean he's the first known. Sure, maybe. I guess that's not.
But
bad
not the
language.
First victim.
But not the first.
But you
victim
need the
by
clickbait.
But that's how people read it.
Yeah.
So I hate articles that are written like that. It was like, oh, the first victim of a knife attack was only 100,000 years ago. That's not bad. No, that's we've been
what
stabbing
do they call
people
it in social media though?
Them.
They call it like a
clickbait.
No, it's not clickbait. It's like the first thing you say. It's the hook.
If you're writing a newspaper article, you have to have the hook in the first sentence, basically.
It did make me read it.
Honestly, like, I don't hate this one as much as I hate some of the other ones.
True.
Because at least it says first known victim. The word known really helps make it a little bit better.
That's true.
Because we don't have an example of somebody getting stabbed in the face that is older than this one, so that would make it the first known.
Yeah.
But it certainly probably isn't the first time it happened, because, like, what are the chances of having that in the archaeological record?
What museum was it that they had the display of early Homo sapiens? Or was it the British Museum, where there was the early Homo hominids with violent ends? Where was that?
That was the Natural History Museum in Washington, D.C., I think.
Oh, was it? Yeah. That was a really good little side display of just bones and skulls that had you know, like a like this one was chomped by an alligator.
Yeah. So there's like a baby skull with like talons in it. Like, oh,
yeah,
you know, a large bird of prey can take off with a human baby just as easily as it can, you like know, a goat. Or whatever. So
what experimental archaeology was that? Like,
oh, God.
Yeah. No, these were real. These were real. Yeah.
Yeah.
So
anyway, I don't know. What do you think of that?
Can you imagine you just get eaten by an alligator and then suddenly you're in a museum like 100,000 years later and like,
I know. You don't want to live on forever.
Have you seen the cartoon thing, which is like, you know, oh man, this is the worst part ever. Oh, well, it's not like anyone will see it ever again. And then it's like, right of place in the museum.
I love that. Yeah.
Nice.
That sounds like a Far Side cartoon.
Yes.
Yeah, I think it is probably a Far Side. Yeah.
Yeah.
Oh my God. Well, anyway, so this is this was found at a cave in Israel. And actually, 1933 is when these were first excavated. This particular find, I don't remember if I saw where that was actually found.
Did you have anything interesting to report about the cave location?
Yes, it is Israel.
Wasn't it? Indeed. It says in the article, it was discovered in Israel. In fact, Israel was not identity then, so
it's a fair point though, like your geography in both time and place correct, that's all we're asking for.
Yes. So 1933, Israel has not become a state, I suppose. So it is in Palestinian occupied what's it called? Well, it's Palestine, but the term is...
Not Palestinian occupied.
No, it's occupied Palestine. We'll say occupied Palestine. Okay. Yeah. Mm-hmm. So, yeah. But the cave is very well known. There's lots of bodies that have come out of it's near Nazareth, I believe. And there's lots of different bodies that seem to have had mortuary practices. And care for them as well. So that's what basically this article is talking about, isn't it? That the it's been healed very well. Mm-hmm. So even if he has accidentally stabbed himself in the face or something, which I'm inclined to believe. What I did find interesting in this article is that the reason why they think, or this researcher who links her own articles as scientific stuff, if you click on the actual links, it's usually an article by her, by Sarah Kuta. So they believe it's because most people are right-handed and therefore it's violence because you fight with your dominant hand.
Right.
Which doesn't tell you the reason why people have a lot of dominance, right-handed dominance throughout history. So I don't think that's necessarily, you can say that's just the reason why it's violent. Mm-hmm. It's definitely sharp and it's maybe a tool, but as someone who routinely stabs themselves with knives, well, you know, cutting stuff, you can happily say maybe it's not entirely violence is the only option there, but
you know, the first thing I thought when I saw this, the cut, if you look at it, it's kind of up between two of the teeth. I'm just like, this guy had some mastodon in his tooth and he's like, I kind of get
flossing like crazy.
He's using a stone tool and then some kid walks by and bumps his arm and he jams it into his jawline.
that's so true, because wasn't one of the earliest kind of hominid tools is a toothpick. Is that not correct? Is that not in...
Is it?
Yeah, it's... Tilly, what was the book we read in Archaeo Book Club?
The
Neanderthals.
Cafe Neanderthal or Kindred?
Kindred. Kindred, by Rebecca Ragland. The way that people are like looking after their teeth, you'll find really big like indents into their actual bone sometimes because they're just like worrying it constantly.
Getting it through.
Yeah.
Well, and people use their teeth as tools quite a lot in early times, especially. And still, in a lot of places around the world, it's used as like an extra hand, basically.
And interestingly enough, at this site, they also found shells which had been drilled with holes in it. So they do think that they were using them to string or to use or something like that. So if they're using twine and string, this is also possible.
Yeah.
But I mean, it is quite a clean cut, so it depends.
It's something sharp. A sharp tool of some sort was in or near this person's mouth and cut it. But I am glad you brought that up, the reason, because it does say in the Smithsonian article, the actual language is probably the result of interpersonal violence, right? Mm-hmm. Because of the whole right-handed thing, all that stuff. But I'm like, yeah, I mean, it doesn't have to be violence, but I think I would focus on the absolute things this does tell us, which is what I love about archaeology. You've got this one little thing here, and it tells us a number of things. First, it tells if they had sharp enough, almost clearly stone tools, because it would be hard for something else. Shell could do this, right? Shell could do this, yeah. But I don't know if, you know, but something, it's more than likely a stone tool, because you can see that it's kind of pointed, right?
Yeah.
And a shell that wouldn't necessarily look like that. But this is like a bifacially worked tool. And then also that it healed, right? It also tells us something about that, because the person was taken care of afterwards, or had people around them to do the other work that they couldn't do because they were, you know, nursing an injury.
That to me is like the way more interesting part. And I find that's true in a lot of these sensational headlines like this, where they're talking about a really grisly injury that they find on the remains of a person. And then they just go on to casually mention that person then lived after that. And I'm like, can we talk about how cool that is, that like they lived in a community or in a family or whatever, a group of people that cared enough about this person to help them heal? Because you can't really do this on your own. You need somebody to give you some kind of care. You can't see your fate. You don't have mirrors 100,000 years ago.
Yeah.
I guess you could go to the water maybe, but like, you need somebody to help you.
Yeah,
with this.
No, yeah.
And then like after that too, not just the taking care of you while you're injured, but like providing for you during your recovery too. There's just so much care that goes into that. And that is so much more interesting to me than, oh, okay, one person stabbed another.
Yeah. Right.
And they have a lot of evidence of that from other species as well, like Homo georgicus and Homo neanderthalensis and stuff. You have some really interesting examples of skulls where basically the teeth have degraded to such an extent that the jaw has also started to degrade away. Mm-hmm. So like we know that they lived without having teeth and without being able to do stuff, and yet they lived for another 5 years or something, which implies that someone was there chewing up the food for them, you know, or whatever. Yeah. And
doing giving
them. And it's, that I think is really interesting. I think there's a lot of so this particular site, this and the what's it called, Skoll, I have no idea how you pronounce it, Skhul, which are both sites in this region of the world that shall remain unnationalized. And the ancient humans that were found there, they're basically the kind of earliest humans, like early modern humans that are found outside of Africa. But it's thought generally that they probably represent like a wave that came out and then sort of failed. So it was kind of one of the first trial runs out of Africa, basically, and then it failed, and then at some point another wave came and another wave came. So there's like all these really complicated things. So that's why this particular site is like really exciting and well-documented and everything, because it's sort of the earliest evidence that we have of us leaving Africa in that stage. But then I think because of that, people like to try and like make all these things. So it's like, oh, they were really violent and that's why it failed. Or like, you know, they were like, it seems... Right. Maybe
it's
that
very clan of the cave bear.
Yeah, for sure.
Did they also invent every single thing?
Person.
Yeah.
Fire.
Water.
Yeah.
So
But I find it funny that they really go through, like, I was trying to read through the article, and it's like every tooth. They're like, well, this tooth had this thing.
Yeah.
The first lower molars had this thing. Then the left P4. And like I said, I went to the dentist today. And I was doing it. I was going, P4 is, you know, M3 is this. I'm going, oh, man.
Whenever they get to my wisdom teeth, they're like, no. I'm like, oh, I don't have them. I don't have my wisdom.
Along those lines, I do feel like people at a lab sometimes tend to get a little over analytical because they're in the lab setting and they're just like every little detail of every little thing. Sometimes you just got to look at the big picture, like, you know,
step back and remember it's a person.
Although, thought you guys would
on the
like
other hand
too.
I would argue that it might be that the little details aren't relevant right now, but potentially in like 20 years when we have amazing technological whatevers, that it's like, oh my gosh, this tiny little detail means that we now know that they were
Absolutely.
I'm curious. I don't know.
Well, I do like looking at like prehistoric teeth because there's no decay. Like there's no like black decay from sugar. It's so, and you can see where they've been grinding stuff, and like that's interesting.
Yeah.
Yeah. In the first paragraph too, you guys noticed where they mentioned the red ochre and they said it was probably from ritual. It literally just said they found the red ochre.
No. Cross platform.
I actually used it in the tea break one the other day as well because I was this is too appropriate because Jess was like, oh no, I'm gonna say ritual, and I was like, it's fine, it's in the other podcast. I was like, actually I have the button here.
I love it. Oh man. All right, what else do you guys have to say about this?
I did also find it interesting that the another columnist Guy Gigliotta? Gigliotta? I'm sorry. I wrote in 2008 that the Homo sapiens may have not been the vanguard of the eventual significant migration to other continents. There is no evidence that these moderns survived for long, much less went on to colonize other parts of the globe.
The globe. Yeah. The globe. Yeah,
but colonize is a very interesting word. But then also like, oh well, they're not very successful. You know, they've been stabbing each other in the faces and not colonizing the rest of the world. And you're like, come on!
If they could get over their interpersonal violence and ritual, if they could get over their interpersonal violence and ritual, they'd probably get somewhere, right?
Yeah, much more different. So they just focused in school.
Write your offer properly.
Learn some critical thinking. But they're not even. I mean, we're not even the first like Homo species to leave Africa. You know, like there's. Neanderthalensis were out there, Homo erectus were out there, Homo floresiensis were out there. Like, it's I guess it's just all of this bias about because it's us, you know. Then
we should be doing more. But then imagine putting modern societal standards on prehistoric people that have been dead for 100,000 years. It's really interesting.
Right?
I'm judging you. But I do think it also lends into the stereotype of. Like we're only interested in the past if it's violence or sex, that's it. Mm-hmm. Like either they were killing each other or they interbred. That's it. There's only two options, you know?
Yeah. It's the only thing that makes the news, right?
I mean, to be fair, it's not like their clothing survives from 150,000 years ago and some of their other things, right? So it's kind of like what we have to go on sometimes. But
like we were just talking about, you can draw different conclusions.
Yeah.
You know, it doesn't have to be all about the violence and the sex. It can be other things too. It's just that that's what they focus on.
Mm-hmm.
Well, and this ties in nicely to what we were just talking about with the LLMs and how it's like, okay, if you're stating facts and doing like analysis compared to like interpreting and making assumptions about things, like it's a lot easier to be like, these people interbred with these people because we know that because the genetic material says that, or like this, violence obviously is like an interpretation, but like this person had something happen to them because of this and this and this. However, if you see like a, what's the oldest one? I think the oldest one is a shell that's dated to the Homo erectus. So like a couple of million. And it's got like these markings on it and everyone's like the first art that you have, like it's scratches, like geometric things, but things like art and like symbolism are so like subjective to actually subjective. So I feel like that's probably why it's always about like sex or, you know, violence or like because those are the only things that you can really objectively sort of say, well, this happened, like something happened, like this person, their head was bashed in with a stone, you know, like it, well, you know.
But then actually we've contradicted that because we've already talked about, and the article kind of so talks about it but then doesn't really go into depth about the funerary practices and also about how people are caring for one another. So actually the evidence isn't necessarily the act of violence, but rather, or whatever violence it would have been, could have been stabbing yourself in the face. But then, like, you know, it's actually the care that comes afterwards in that society. So that's the more important story. Yeah. But instead, we trivialize it and it becomes a violent act against two people.
Right.
Yeah.
Right.
No. Yeah, for sure. Mm. Like, violent acts don't mean that a society was moving forward, but taking care of the people in your community does help a society grow and move forward and develop. So like, again, it's just much more interesting.
Yeah. It is much more interesting.
So I guess was more the article had that focus. And a lot of people have already talked about like, oh, yeah, they cared for people. So I guess it's not new and exciting. It's not a hook anymore.
It's not a hook.
People cared about people. Whatever.
Yeah, change the heading. Man stabs himself in face, gets cared for the rest of his life.
But it's okay.
But at least when you talk about it. Because like, you know, if you have to have a hook to get people to come in and read about it and then learn all of the like kind of more interesting things that these remains tell you, then I think I'm okay with that. Use your hook, I guess.
Maybe you could do it like...
Yeah.
Sorry.
No, go ahead. Go ahead.
I was going to say, well, maybe you could do it more like, how does man survive? How did the oldest stab victim survive? Or something like that.
Yeah,
you know, like,
true.
Like, it can still get that little hooky thing, but then you also have, like, a change of perspective.
Right. Mm-hmm.
I just noticed the caption on the full left-hand side of the skull says the injury is found on the left side of a man's face, which suggests it may have resulted from a face-to-face confrontation. Somebody's trying to make a little bit of a joke here.
I just love it. If it was like a really bad, like a silly accident. You know, like a proper cartoonish-esque accident where like someone was just like, I tripped and then the spear and then,
I'm telling you, I think it was a kid that bumped his arm while he was cleaning his teeth. He was very next to several children because they went too.
Yeah, that child burial that's in the same site.
That's what I'm saying. That kid got chucked in the fire, I think.
I wonder if you could figure that out, though, because of the angle and everything. You could figure out the angle of the way the weapon came in, and then you could figure out if maybe the arm would extend in that way to hit the foot. I mean, it is kind of like there, isn't it? Like just in the corner of the, just the front of the mouth there. Mm-hmm. So it makes sense.
Let's have David Ian Howe from Ethnocynology do that on his YouTube channel with some experimental archaeology.
Yeah. David, step up.
Like, on the elbow.
All right, anything else? I think we can nail it.
Kind of it.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
So I guess in summary, it's kind of sure, maybe interesting, but like there's much more interesting things we can talk about.
Yeah, for sure.
Yeah.
Okay. Well then I guess that's it for this week's or month's journal club. Mm-hmm. So yeah. We didn't put this one out on our we didn't live simulcast this one on our Discord channel because we couldn't really share the video last time. It doesn't really work out that way, but maybe we'll figure out some way to live stream these in the future, but for now we've just got it on YouTube, so leave your comments, tell us what you like and don't like about it. Be brutal. I know you will. So all right. Okay guys, well I guess that's it. We'll see you next month.
Bye.
Thanks for listening to The Archaeology Show. Feel free to comment and view the show notes on the website at www.arcpodnet.com. Find us on Facebook, Instagram, and Twitter at arcpodnet. Music for this show is called I Wish You Would Look from the band Sea Hero. Again, thanks for listening and have an awesome day. Thanks for listening to this podcast. The Archaeology Podcast Network's chief editor is Rachel Roden. Our executive producer is Ashley Airy. Our social media and newsletter coordinator is Matilda Siebrecht. The APN was founded by Chris Webster and Tristan Boyle on December 1st, 2014. We're supported by our amazing podcast hosts, many volunteers, and listeners like you. Check out membership at www.arcpodnet.com/members.
This has been a presentation of the Archaeology Podcast Network. Visit us on the web for show notes and other podcasts at www.archpodnet.com. Contact us at chris@archaeologypodcastnetwork.com.